Welcome to the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection, where Colorado trial lawyers share insights from their latest cases. Join me, Keith Buscelli, as we uncover the stories, strategies, and lessons from recent Colorado trials to help you and your clients achieve justice in the courtroom. The pursuit of justice starts now. All right, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection podcast. Excited to have one repeat amazing attorney, Tim Garvey, coming back, and one new first-time appearance, I'm sure there'll be many more, Greg Bentley from Dormer Harpering, to talk about an amazing $8 million verdict involving a Lime scooter and some kind of Denver City sidewalk, which I thought we always declined those cases. So there is so much to unpackage and learn. So without further ado, welcome back, Tim, and welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks, Keith.
Thanks, Keith, so much for having us on. It's an honor to be on anytime, especially a second time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always say it's like awesome when you come back again and again and again, because it just means that you are continuing to crush verdicts. So we will continue to have people on so long as they just keep doing, and you know, you don't even have to like necessarily get an amazing result. It's more just being in the arena. And I'm actually glad that this is coming up, because to any of our listeners out there, if you went, it's not about the size of the case. It's not about if you won. It is about whether or not other people can learn from your experience. And if other people can learn, maybe the facts of your case were unique, you did something unusual, you lost, you got your ass handed, please reach out to me, because we would love to have you on so that all of our fellow Colorado trial warriors can get better. So with that further ado, welcome back, Tim. And Greg, since you've not been on before, tell us a little bit about yourself. How is it that you came to become a trial lawyer?
Hey, Keith. Thanks for having me on, first of all. Love the show. I'm listening to it all the time, and I've got really great takeaways from previous guests. So thanks for doing this, of course.
Yeah.
I came to Colorado to go to DU Law because I love Colorado and love the mountains, and I just didn't want to work in finance. And I'm glad that I came to DU and went to school with Tim and started out doing a little bit of pharmaceutical litigation, some commercial lit, and then found my way into personal injury, and I love it. I love helping people and working with Tim, and I love being at Dormer Harpering with all the guys.
Yeah, great firm. The values and what they're doing there, really walking. They don't just talk the talk. They walk the walk with what they're doing in the courtroom trial-wise. I just love seeing what you guys are doing. So did you mention that you were from Chicago then originally before you came to DU?
El Paso, Texas.
El Paso, Texas. Okay. So is that you grew up and went to high school in Texas?
I went to high school in El Paso, and then I moved to Austin, Texas to go to college. Went to UT for a little bit and graduated St. Ed's with a business degree. Moved back to El Paso, and the mountains were calling and law school was calling, and ended up at DU, and I love it. I haven't left since.
Wow, that's a pretty cool story, only because it seems like everyone raves about Austin. You might be one of the, you know, I guess I don't know that many people that have gone from Austin to here. So, I mean, what do you think? Is this way better here?
I think this is a lot, you know, it's pretty similar. It's like Austin and the mountains, a little bit more space to spread out and not as many Texans, which is good.
Yeah. All right. So Greg, you come out to Colorado. Was Dormer Harpering your first job, or what kind of legal work did you do before you found yourself there?
It wasn't. I started on a huge DockerView project at Riley Posner.
Ooh.
And it kind of found my way into mass torts. I'd done a little bit of product liability, defective product during law school. And so I kind of went into products liability, pharmaceutical stuff, and did some defective drugs, some SSRI birth defect cases. And then I ran with our mesh litigation, and we worked on common benefits stuff and the MDLs on that for several years. And I kind of started to branch out from that and just do, you know, one-off personal injury cases in Colorado. And I really liked it.
Okay.
And I started Dormer Harpering about a year ago. So it's been doing mostly personal injury since then.
So it was all the mass tort stuff at Riley Posner?
It was at Riley Posner, and then we spun off into Zoni's Law for a while, which is the same group from Riley Posner, but same people, same cases for about a decade or so.
So I'm excited to have someone with that kind of litigation background, because I'm not 100% sure if any of our other guests have done that kind of high-level mass tort work. What aspects of doing that type of work, I guess, first of all, I want to know, like, what did you like and what did you not like? And what is the most useful thing that you learned doing that type of work that you apply to single event car crash type cases?
Yeah. And I think Tim will be able to talk about it too. I come in with a different perspective, obviously, because I was doing different stuff. And one of the things that's very different in the pharmaceutical MDL litigations is we go around the country taking video depositions, because when you have a trial, you can't bring all these people from across the country to trial. And so now I've been very focused on doing video depositions with the aim to play them at trial pretty much my whole career. And so, you know, when I come in and do these one-off cases in Colorado, it seems like people aren't as accustomed to making your depositions for trial. I don't look at them as a discovery depot. And we did this in this case we just tried. We played a lot of 30B6 video, and we'll talk about more. But I think that that's a unique thing that's different from the national mass tort stuff. I spent a lot of time doing a lot of expert work, a lot of briefing, a lot of Daubert fights. And so I really see, you know, the way that game plays out. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that you get as much traction doing expert challenges in the state court here as compared to federal counterpart. But you know, I think I have a lot of experience in expert work and developing experts, attacking experts, which, you know, I think that helps bring a different perspective to some of the one-off stuff in state court. You know, some of the stuff that I like better about the one-off cases is that I really get to know the client. Mm. You really put a face to the person, you connect. You know, I did go do a bunch of plaintiff depositions across the country in mass torts, but that'd be the one time I would see them. And yeah. You know, I really, as a person, as a human, I really enjoy connecting with the clients. And I hope that makes you a better advocate at the end of the day, because, you know, you really care about the people, and it's easier to go be authentic in front of the jury when you have that connection with your client, which it makes me feel good at the end of the day. I like helping people.
So two thoughts come to mind. First of all, I'm assuming that you were probably a really good legal writer before you went to Zonies, or you were decent and then became a great legal writer. But I feel 99.99% sure you are an amazing legal writer. So talk to us a little bit about what you perceive to be the importance of strong, effective legal writing. And perhaps most importantly, what can people do if they recognize, you know what, I need some help here. Like, is there AI? Do we run this through Hemingway, which is like some AI to like help me become a better writer? What can people do?
Just slow down, take the time. You know, I wasn't a great writer to start out with. I wasn't rocking my writing class. I wasn't top of the class. I wasn't law review, but I just put in the time. And that's the secret sausage. Just do the work and go back. And I might spend longer than some at my writing, but I do think that's a strength that I bring. You know, I dig in, I do all my own research, do all my own writing. And at the end of the day, it really helps the case. It's really, really important because obviously, you know, so many battles are fought before you get to trial. You know, in the mass tort stuff and the pharmaceutical stuff, writing was extremely important. And we had the time and the opportunity to spend, you know, to put enough time into getting it right. Mm. Like sometimes in our one-off cases, we don't have as much time to do it right, but, you know, I still try to slow down and do that. But it's very important, I think.
Yeah. Thing that you were talking about that really landed with me is this idea of using depositions in trial. And I'm thinking, of course, about Satch Oliver, Depositions Are Trial. And I had to miss trial 2 weeks ago. I'll tell you all about that off the air. But we were ready to roll with designating testimony, and it really is effective. So for younger listeners, what would you tell them is the mindset of getting that soundbite to play in trial? What should they be thinking about in a deposition is the end goal?
Well, I mean, it's the same thing. You got to put in the preparation, do the reps before you get there. We're not just going in, asking questions to figure things out. You got to have a game plan going in there and figure out what it is you want to ask and what you think they could say to help your case. And Tim and I strategized for the 30B6 depots in this case. Mm. What are the 10 most damaging things this witness can say to really help us? And we'd write them down. And then we try to make a game plan to try and get those questions. Which I think that is some of the Satch Oliver strategy. You know, but big picture, when I was cutting video depots for trial and the pharmaceutical stuff, I'd be cutting depositions from 20 or 30 different attorneys. And I started to see recurring issues. You got to think through how you're going to structure your examination so that when you play the different chapters or whatever you're going to play a trial, it has a flow. And while you don't know exactly what the witness is going to say or where your good stuff's going to be, I think it's helpful to at least have like an organization of how you would set up your deposition, this before this and then this, so that if it all plays out together, it's a smoother deposition clip at trial rather than being disjointed.
And when you're looking at all these different attorneys across the country, are the really great attorneys in depositions, when they get a question and answer that is like pretty good, are they always sort of re-asking the question, looking for that really tight soundbite so that when you're reading through the deposition, it's almost like every single question of substance that is good is essentially asked two or three different ways, just looking for that tight soundbite?
Yeah, I think that's an absolutely good practice to do. You know, depending on what the objections are and what the answer are, and Tim does this very effectively as well, keep asking it to see if you can get it a little bit better, a little bit tighter, a little bit cleaner. Because when you're asking the questions, you may not be aware of how it came off. And so it's better to take a couple of tries, you know, to get the best you can. And then obviously you can decide what to designate a trial and you have more material to work with.
In the mass tort world, I'm assuming in these depositions, there's multiple people there that are sliding you notes. So like if you didn't quite get the soundbite, you know. And that's not the reality very often in the one-off cases. How do you guys do it in your office? For example, on these 30B6 depositions that we're going to talk about, Tim, were you there as well? Were you taking these depos? Were you both partner, you know, being there as partners to each other to make sure you got what you needed?
Yeah. So I'm happy to chime in here. Although Greg's doing great. And I'll tell you, Greg was invaluable in this case. And he's been a huge addition to our firm coming with that background knowledge. Greg and I were law school classmates and we stayed in touch. And when I knew he was sort of thinking of exploring other options from where he was, I was like, we got to get him on board with that experience. And so this is actually the second case that we've taken almost to trial. The other one literally settled on the Sunday before, or maybe the Friday before trial was to start. So Greg's been a huge help to us. You were talking about Satch Oliver. There was a huge, huge influence on this case. So I came back from last year's CTLA convention. Satch spoke on Saturday. There was like not nearly enough people in that room. And everybody who was not there missed on sort of a legal genius in our field. He's fantastic. I heard him talk. I bought depositions or trial. And the next 30B6 I had was this case. And wow. So when I was preparing for this case, I flipped through his book and I was like, yeah, man, these are such great ideas. And so I worked on what are the worst things that this deponent can say? And among them were, this was reckless. This never should have been left this way. We knew better. We didn't do better. It was reckless. I can't tell you how many video clips we have of the general contractor's 30B6 deponent saying, yeah, this is reckless.
Let me interrupt for a second. Did he use the term reckless without your prodding, or did he use other words? And then you said, based upon Satch's book, do you think that was reckless on your part? How did it play out?
Yeah, so it's you got to lead them there, right? So it was a combination of what are the worst things that they can say, and then the Miller's mousetrap, right? Like this is the rule. It's been the rule for a long time. It would be dangerous to violate this rule. It would be reckless to violate this rule. You see a sidewalk like this, it's reckless. It's reckless to leave it in this condition. You should have known better. It should have been repaired a long, long time ago, like the day it happened. It's reckless to leave it for a year and a half looking like this. So, I mean, that's pretty much how it went down, was using that. But the other thing that I've done with depositions is, for the most part, I'm taking depositions, especially big, important ones, using PowerPoint.
Yes.
And so I create a PowerPoint slide that's got text on that. It's got my exhibits incorporated into it. So I'm having a conversation via Zoom with my witnesses. This was reckless, true or false?
Yes. And then are you marking them as exhibits during the deposition, right? That's what you're doing, right?
Sometimes, not always. And in this one, I didn't always do that, but we managed to play, I mean, an hour. So we had the project owner, who was MCI.
Can you give the listeners the overview of the facts of this case? We know, I think I said before, $8 million verdict.
Yeah.
What are the facts of this case?
So the facts of this case, our client was a 60-year-old man who had lived in a big apartment complex on the outskirts of Denver. He had purchased an e-scooter online for his own personal use. So like a Lime scooter, but not a rental. It was his own personal one. He was tooling around his apartment complex. It was a nice spring day, and he was trying to just get used to riding this thing. And so it was only the second time he'd ever ridden it. In his parking lot, he encountered sort of a bumpy section of the parking lot and thought to himself as he was ready to go home, I want to avoid that. So he went out to the sidewalk and he decides he's going to take the sidewalk back home outside of his apartment complex. So What he didn't know was that MCI a year and a half earlier had done a infrastructure project where they were putting in fiber optic cables under the sidewalk. Well, to do that, they had a general contractor and a subcontractor who busted up the sidewalk and then put in a handhole. It's a plastic junction box. It's kind of like a manhole, just big enough for your hand. So they call it a handhole instead of a manhole.
Okay.
And instead of replacing the concrete, which everybody agrees should have been replaced then and there, the subcontractor took up the broken chunks of concrete and put them together like a jigsaw puzzle and left them there.
Wow. Was it in the, I'm thinking to myself, wasn't it in the original bid to do this project to replace? Isn't there like a line item at the end to
It was in the permit. It was in the plan. It was in the contract.
Wow.
And I'll let Greg talk a little bit about, I mean, there was some, who was responsible for it became an issue at trial. And we took some real chances at trial led by Greg in trying to nail that down and who was responsible. Had a surprise witness at trial that we had never talked to before. Weren't sure what he was going to say, but we felt pretty good about how it was going to come out. It was the owner of the subcontractor who basically came in and said, not my responsibility to replace it. I dig holes. The general contractor fixes those holes.
All right. So your client is, so this is a premises liability case. And I assume we're all, well, how many defendants were there? I know, I think I heard at least two. Were there more?
So ultimately, as we were preparing for trial, there were the city, who we ultimately settled for just before trial. And then we had the general contractor, and we had the project owner, who was MCI. I didn't actually talk about what happened to our client. So he hits this mangled sidewalk, flips over his scooter, spends 10 days in the ICU, has a moderate traumatic brain injury that basically killed a chunk of his brain. He had a chunk of his brain missing.
Wow.
Also ultimately needed, I think it was a 3-level fusion in his neck. Also some potential recommendations for a fusion in his lumbar spine. And he was never the same. He tried going back to work and got fired because he couldn't do the job. He wasn't the person he was before.
Wow.
And so, you know, I mean, life-changing injuries for a guy for something that never needed to happen.
All right. So only because it's popping in my mind, what did the defense, and Greg, I don't know if you want to take this, what did the defense do fighting medical, the extent of these impairments? I mean, it sounds really bad. Was this a hard-fought battle, or was it more, not our problem, we're not going to fight you on the medicine?
Yeah, they didn't really fight on the medicine. They brought in two experts who essentially agreed with everything. They, you know, Tim took one of the experts through a 2 hours review of the medical records and got her to agree to, you know, three giant flipboard pages of all the injuries that our client had, and that she had no reason to dispute any of it, and she agreed to all of it. At the end of the day, she issued an opinion that said our client had a moderate brain injury. And her only really differing opinion was that she thought maybe he could get a job somewhere, somehow, sometime, maybe for compensation, maybe for no compensation. That was really the only difference of opinion. So they didn't really fight it on the, they didn't bring any experts in. They didn't have any other doctors. It was kind of odd. They definitely crossed our experts and tried to poke holes in some of the stuff, but I don't really think that's where the case was. And they were just trying to, you know, fight liability and knowledge under PLA type stuff.
Yeah. The case that I just missed probably was a similar situation in which I was almost thinking, like, are they going to even call their defense experts? Because they're going to be very good for us if they do. But I wanted to touch base a little bit, mainly for the listeners, about this idea of using PowerPoints in depositions. Because I do want to share something that I did in this case that we were in trial in. And it was a case where it was a 30B6. And he was so adverse to us, he wouldn't agree to anything. And so I was creating in PowerPoint a PDF of like, so you would agree X, Y, and Z. And he'd be like, well, I don't know that I would call it a rule. Okay, what would you call it? Then I would change it. Okay. And I kid you not, it was hilarious. We did this for 25 minutes and I went through 13 exhibits until I finally got one that he would agree that, okay, so you agree with all of these things, like Rick Friedman rules of the road stuff. You agree with all of these rules, boom, 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 and eventually yes. But what was beautiful is I could use it in opening without any, not even having to worry about it. Like, go ahead, try and tell the judge you're not going to let me use this slide in opening. And actually, we focus grouped it. And when we designated his testimony, we included all that 25 minutes because it just looked so evasive. And maybe that was going to be a mistake on our part. But sounds like maybe, Tim, you were using PowerPoints a little bit differently. I was more in my mind thinking, I'm going to create an exhibit that I'm going to use this deponent to authenticate that I can then use at trial. Is there sort of a different angle that you're using PowerPoints in your depositions that we can all learn from?
Well, so I think a little bit different, which is I've always made, and especially for 30B6, outlines of depositions. And so what I've started doing is basically putting my outline of the deposition into a PowerPoint. And so using, for anyone that is familiar with PowerPoint, and if you're not, there's a great book called Beyond Bullet Points by Cliff Atkinson that I would highly recommend everybody read and absorb. But there's speaker notes. And so the outline for my deposition pretty much goes into my speaker notes. And then I've got images for every other question type of a thing, or I'll put my question on the screen. I mean, it's a 30B6. There's not a whole lot of surprises, right? Like, we got to tell them what we're asking about anyway. And so I will literally sometimes put the main question up on the screen and say true or false.
Wow, that's super fun. I love that.
And I've had some deponents who hate because they're confronted with the actual statement. And you're simply asking them yes or no, true or false. And they will fight you like hell sometimes, especially if it's something they don't want to admit. But when it's laid bare to them of true or false, is this statement true or is it false? And you just press them on that, you'll get the response. And if you do it right, either answer is great for you.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun. It takes a lot of work, but all of this takes a lot of work. If you want to do it right, you got to do it. You got to put in the time. There are no shortcuts. That's the takeaway for the listeners, right? There's no shortcuts.
Yeah, you're not strolling into a 30B6 deposition, winging it, getting the sound bites, doing the depositions or trial. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So, all right, let's go back to the case then a little bit. I know that you were in Denver and it was Judge Wallace, correct?
Right.
What types of critical sort of pre-trial rulings were there central issues that Judge Wallace had to rule on?
I'm going to let Greg talk on this because I brought him in late on the case. So when it sort of looked like we're definitely going to trial, I said, this one's big and complicated. I'm going to let Greg get involved. And it was great having Greg involved because he came to it with a fresh set of eyes a year into litigation and said, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I said, great, great questions. Run with it. And he did. And it came to the briefing. You know, Greg really undersold himself when he talked about writing. Greg is great. And more than that, he's tenacious. I mean, I can't tell you the number of hours where I know Greg went to bed at 2 a.m, especially weeks leading up to trial, and then got back up and sending me more emails at 6 a.m, digging in, reading 100 and 150 cases on premises liability law to make sure that we're getting the right answer and doing the best we can. So Greg was instrumental in that. So I'm happy to let him talk about that.
Yeah, Greg, talk to us a little bit about motions in limine. I think we've kind of got a pretty good understanding of the facts. What sort of fascinating legal issues came up?
Well, the first ruling that was kind of interesting is Judge Wallace granted defense's motion to dismiss the negligence claim before we'd had a ruling on the landowner status, which we disagreed with. And so, you know, I told her, we were at the pretrial conference. I was like, Your Honor, I apologize, but we're about to file a motion to reconsider. I don't do that lightly. And, you know, she kind of looked at me sideways. I was like, really? Like, really? And she ended up granting our motion to reconsider, you know, so she reversed herself, you know, to get it right, which I really appreciate. You got to have your negligence claim in until you have the landowner determination. It's one or the other.
So let's talk about that because this comes up all of the time.
Totally.
And this is one of those nuggets that our listeners are going to take from this. So educate us. We all file these, you know, we get a case that comes in, you know, it's a PLA case, but you file the negligence claim too.
Yep.
What I'm hearing you say is that, did she just sua sponte?
No.
All right, so give us the lay of the land and what do we need to know to not screw this up?
So I think it was on summary judgment briefing. Defendants came in, you know, they wouldn't admit landowner and Tim was trying to pin him into it appropriately. Okay. They wouldn't do that. Then they, you know, they said they should get the negligence claim dismissed because PLA applies, even though they wouldn't admit the PLA applies. It was very odd. And so there's a case, the Vigil case, where there's some weird dicta in it, which kind of almost gets to the point where it says PLA applies, even if it's a negligence claim and it still abrogates, which it was kind of odd. But ultimately, that's not what the law says in Colorado. You got to have both claims. You know, and my takeaway would be absolutely plead both of them until you get a ruling on landowner, because there's plenty of case law that says if you don't have both, it's too late if you lose your PLA claim and it's really negligence. So you absolutely need both. And that's kind of what I think defense is starting to try and game. They're trying to get the courts to bite on, pour out the negligence claim because PLA applies. And then they're going to turn around and say, oh, but we're not a landowner, which that gamesmanship really shouldn't fly. And it didn't fly here. Luckily, we got the right ruling. But, you know, I've seen on the list there, but there's definitely, it seems like a recurring practice on defense to try that game. So
let me ask you a practice pointer on that. So if I have a case where we play, you know, it's pled as PLA and negligence, and then we do written discovery and we admit that you are a landowner pursuant to the PLA. Once they say, yes, we admit, then do we ask them to just dismiss it voluntarily? Do we stipulate to dismiss the negligence claim? Is it like without prejudice? So then if they change their mind later on, we can come in and add it later. What is the best practice when it comes to that issue?
I think if you papered it with a dismissal without prejudice where everybody agreed after they've answered it, I think you're probably protected. I would just wait, you know, because they could certainly change their discovery answers later on. Something could come up later. And I just would want to protect myself to where I'm not going to lose the case based upon some gamesmanship. But
and let me jump in just real quick on that. And in hindsight, it's maybe something that we would have done a little bit different. I think to some extent, we're trying to be too honest. And what I mean by that is we thought that this was a PLA claim. And so we were ready to sort of confess that this was a PLA claim. But maybe we had a chance at negligence. And so I think sort of my takeaway on this is maybe you plead both and then you figure out a way, you know, which is it? Do you actually have a legitimate claim for negligence? Have they given up possession of the land such that they're no longer a landowner? And maybe explore some of those things. Because the truth is, if you can have a negligence claim or a PLA claim, damn it, I'll take that negligence claim every day.
All day.
Right? And so I think really exploring it and not accepting the fact that it's PLA, try to keep that negligence claim. I think that's an important sort of piece until they either prove to you that it can't be a negligence claim or the court tells you it can't be a negligence claim. I'll tell you, judges dislike the PLA statute and the case law surrounding it as much as we do, right? Yeah. They have a hard time trying to figure out what's going on and how to make sense of all this and all this sort of different cases that kind of sort of maybe say one thing or another, right? And so, So that's my thought process on that, right?
So let's give the listeners just some black letter law of when the PLA applies, how you can have more than one landowner, when that's determined, just for I don't know who, Greg, yeah. Tim, I don't know who wants to kind of educate our listeners on the black letter law on when PLA applies versus negligence.
So, you know, PLA is going to apply where there's a dangerous condition on property. You know, that's the big picture.
Yep.
PLA is going to only apply as to landowners. And you think landowner, that's got to be the, you know, the legal title, the person that owns the property, but it's really not. It's been, you know, massively expanded beyond that. You know, and the statute says it's not limited to just ownership. It's whoever has control of the property, which even that seems clear, but it's not. It really gets ambiguous. And especially where you have, you know, a general contractor with subcontractors in different layers and entities, it gets super confusing. And so I would definitely try to keep your backup claim in for negligence, you know, until as late as possible.
I just want to jump in real quick. So it's control or creation of the danger, right? So it gets right. even beyond that.
Well, that's not clear necessarily, because you could have created the danger. And if you've completely given up control to where you had no ability to then fix it, you know, and a couple of years later, you may not be a landowner at that point, but that'd be great because then you have a negligence claim.
Right.
So that really takes a full circle. Try and hold both of those claims in until the last minute when you're sure you have a viable claim, you know, under one of the theories.
So talk to us about how the city was. You said you had named the city and then you settled with the city. What's the current, I thought whenever the city, they have no responsibility for sidewalks, what was the claim against the city in your case?
You want me to take that one, Greg?
Yeah.
So it was ownership, right? They owned the sidewalk. This event happened in 2022. Was it 22? Okay. I think it happened in 2022. I know there's been changes in the law in terms of, you know, who's responsible. And that sort of came up in this case too. There was all sorts of issues about whether the city had noticed and whether nearby residents had reported the dangerous sidewalk to them. So there were notice issues. There were landowner issues. They technically own the land on which the side, is there. So, you know, it was one of those things where we filed that claim, it was supported, and we were able to settle with them for an amount that made it worthwhile, given the caps, right, to get them out of the case.
Interesting occurrence. You know, this happened during COVID. And so Denver changed their sidewalk inspection practices during COVID. And so they wouldn't send anybody out to go inspect sidewalks really during this. So even if they had got noticed, they would be like, we're not going out and dealing with it right now. So it created a weird situation.
City workers at its finest. Did you guys have a Greenemeier instruction because of the settlement, or were you able to keep that out? Greg, you're shaking your head no.
Tim can talk about it more, but the answer is no.
Every time I know Greenemeier well, and it's like, it really is used by, I feel like courts all the time give instructions. Greenemeier, there were the people were at the trial at the beginning, and then they were not. So like it made sense to give it, but it sounds like your case, you settled with Denver before, is that right? Before trial?
We did a couple of weeks before trial. The reality is that neither side proposed the Greenemeier instruction, but it did come in that we had settled with Denver. So
how did it come in?
The defense in opening said they settled with Denver. And so, I mean, it was one of those things that was sort of back and forth with the court, but we avoided an actual Greenemeier instruction. I thought like the instruction would only further highlight the fact of it. And so I wasn't going to propose it, and the defense didn't propose one. And
did the amount of the settlement come in, or just the settlement?
The amount did not. I raised an issue because to me, if Greenemeier does apply, it applies in that the fact of settlement can come in, but not the amount.
Right.
The defense in opening said he's already been compensated. And my position on that was, well, that's telling the jury that he settled for an amount of money and you can't do that. But I didn't really press that issue with the court. I thought it was a little.
And was there no motion in limine, just like one of those things that just like got slipped by and then all of a sudden defense gets up and does that?
Yeah, no, I think.
It was timing.
I think it was a timing thing. And we knew it was coming, and there's strategy sometimes. Do we things head on and make an issue of it, or do we just sort of accept it? Nod our heads when they say, then the plaintiff settled with the city. Yep.
Let me ask you this in closing, because one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about recently is explaining things more to the jury about you cannot consider who's going to pay for it, what's going to pay, whether the judge is going to reduce this or not. So it seems like in a case like yours where they're told about this settlement, I mean, I'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission, get up in closing and talk about how you've heard about the settlement. That's going to be taken care of by the court afterwards. You can't consider it. Did that come up at all by any chance? Like, and I guess the real question is, do you think, doesn't seem like it hurt you guys at all? Because was there apportionment then between the city? So what, I know the verdict was $8 million and change. What was the division of responsible parties?
So the jury came back with 35% against the general contractor, 35% against the subcontractor, and then 15% against City of Denver, and 15% against our client.
Okay. Were they going hard on the negligence of your client? Was that something you guys really had to address hard in closing?
Yeah. We thought they were going to go harder. And maybe we were effective enough in heading it off that they didn't press it as hard. I think they only asked for 10% against our client. We suggested 5 to 10%. But they definitely were suggesting that our client did something wrong. And so we worked with Jesse Wilson a lot to prepare our client for testifying. And I was probably three times harder on our client than defense was. You know, I went through.
In your direct?
Yeah. I crossed our client pretty hard, but he did really well. You know, I tried to go through everything that anybody could think about and lay it all out there. And they still gave him 15%, which it's all right. He's on a scooter on a sidewalk, but I thought they were going to go harder in closing. They didn't really push it as hard. I think the defense attorney even commented that plaintiff's attorney said we were going to come blame the client, but we only want 10%. You know, and the jury still gave him 15%. So I'm not sure how that happened, but
they tried to put a lot on the non-parties, right? Oh. So the city of Denver and the subcontractor who we didn't sue, largely due to the non-delegable duties, right?
Yep. Yeah. So I want to come back to the subcontractor issue, but talk to us a little bit about your experience working with Jesse Wilson. So for listeners that haven't, you know, worked with him, what do you think? How did that affect your client and your case?
Yeah. So let me start that and then I'll kick it over to Greg, because I think it was Greg's really his first time working with him. But I've worked with Jesse for probably close to a decade now.
Wow.
He was one of the first people, probably the first trial consultant I ever worked with. And I just thought he was doing a seminar out in LA in a small theater space. And Nick Rowley actually recommended him. I posted on the Trial by Human listserv. Hey, anyone know about this Jesse Wilson? And Nick chimed in and said, he's fantastic. Go. So, all right, I guess I'm going to go. And I've worked steadily with Jesse ever since. I think Jesse is a bit of a magician when it comes to helping prepare witnesses, to strategizing your case. He worked with me on opening in this case as well. And I'll continue to use Jesse for as long as he's doing trial consult work. But Greg, this was sort of your first time in a room with him working with a client. Do you want to?
Yeah, this is actually my second time. You know, Tim and I have worked on two cases since I've been over at Dormer Harpering, and we worked with Jesse Wilson last time. That case didn't go to trial. This was the first time really substantively working with Jesse, and he's freaking awesome. Like, I would agree with calling him a magician. He definitely helps find the story and find a way for your client to communicate the story that I think the jury understands, and it's really helpful for the ultimate outcome of the case. And I would heavily, heavily recommend using Jesse Wilson for TBI cases specifically. I saw how he approaches it and his strategies and structures, and he has that dialed in, and it's absolutely incredible. And I'm very interested in, you know, continuing to represent clients with those injuries. You know, it's a very, you know, personal interest that I have. And, you know, I think those are very recurring injuries that we have. And it was fascinating to see how he approached it, how he explained it, you know, through a structure, but each witness has this story. Each client has a story. And it was just really powerful.
Yeah, we worked with him on the mistrial case as well, and it was really eye-opening. I'm excited to do more with him in the future, for sure. Talk to us a little bit about your damage ask and how, I mean, this was a phenomenal result. How did you guys come up with what to ask for? And I don't know that we covered what were your, I mean, it sounds like your client was in the hospital for a long period of time, so I'm assuming medical bills are pretty high. What was the sort of the lay of the economic, non-economic and impairment land?
So he had, I think, about 600,000, 700,000 in medicals that were stipulated. And so that was easy to get that in. Tim put on the life care planner, Helen Woodard, which I think the upper was 3.6 million, but it was still a conservative life care plan. You know, and defense didn't put on a competing life care planner. They tried to beat her up a little bit. She did phenomenal and Tim did a great job. So we came in with 4.2 economic damages. And the jury gave us every penny. You know, there was some part of the life care plan was a 1.5 million future fusion of the neck. And defense tried to argue that, well, he hasn't gotten it yet. How do you know he's going to get it in the future? And the jury didn't buy it. You know, they gave us every dollar for future care. So that was great. I asked for 2 million in non-economics. I said, don't give us a penny more. And they listened to me and they put 2 million on the line. Okay. And then we asked for more. They gave us 2 million in impairment, which is a one for one on the non-economics. We kind of discussed some of the impairments our client had. You know, he has like sleep issues. He only gets 1 hour of sleep at a time each night, which is terrible. And so, you know, I was like, I suggested they should evaluate the sleep impairment and then they should evaluate his executive function impairment and separately. And I suggested that those numbers, they could have a range and it would add up, you know, to a big number, but the jury ended up coming back with 2 million in impairment, you know, to get us to 8.2 total, which is, you know, a great result for our client.
Yeah. One of the things that we use big data on recently, and I just put this out there because in bigger cases like this, I think it can be useful. So we had a case where we're going to be asking for between $30 and $50 million. And we were trying to decide what to ask for on non-economics and toyed with the idea of doing not a penny more than a million, but then ran big data asking for 5 million or a million. And asking for five, even though we know it's capped, got better results on everything. So we were planning, had we actually made it there, to ask for five on non-economics and then range of impairments. And it also reminds me, there's a woman lawyer that's really involved in Hostage to Hero. And Tim, I think you turned me on to, sorry, De La Mar, weren't you really involved in Hostage to Hero back in the day?
Yep.
Are you still? Yeah.
Yep.
I went out and did trial lab with her, and that's Triple C. Yeah. Triple C is her name. The woman that does the impairment house. So, and by the way, another fun practice pointer, you can use AI to do this because I did it in this trial. I went in and I put in, I forget, I used like Perplexity or something. And I just put in, create a house, a demonstrative house showing the following levels of impairments. I just put the different amounts for each different types of impairment. And like, boom, it just created this really cool looking demonstrative exhibit thing to use if you wanted to do the impairment. I don't know, it was pretty, because it sounds like that's kind of what you were essentially doing, is breaking the impairments up into the specific rooms, if you will, and asking them to sort of appraise the value of each room. Is that kind of the
theory? Yeah,
that's
what I was trying. I like this. This house sounds fascinating. Interested to see that.
It's pretty cool. Honestly, go back. You can go to Sari's podcast and find the one where she talked. Her name's Christy Childs King or something. I don't know. They call her Triple C, but she has the impairment house. And what I love about it is the point is, look, if you're going to appraise the value of a house, you got to appraise every single room in that house. You can talk about like the White House. And obviously the Oval Office is, if you're appraising the value, the Oval Office is a lot. But you know what? The janitor's closet in the basement, you still have to appraise the value of that janitor's closet in the basement. And so my brain was spinning listening to this because I'm like, man, this could be really cool. Now, she does it with non-economic damages in states where you're not handicapped here. But mm-hmm. I figured with impairment, it really could be kind of broken out into. And the other thing that she does that's really cool, I highly encourage listeners to go back and listen to the Sari de Lamont podcast. You'll have to find it. But she tells the people in opening that this witness is going to talk about this room. And so she tells them in opening that this is what it's going to be and that each room in that house is going to have a witness that's going to testify to it. It's pretty cool.
I love it.
Yeah.
No, so that's great. And you talked about big data.
Yes.
We worked with Jessica Brilo to do some focus groups and to do a data study for us in this case as well. So
okay. Talk to us a little bit about that, because we were just talking about using her in a different case. We had used Campbell's for big data on other ones. If people are not familiar with what Jessica Brilo does, what kind of assistance did she give you in this case?
So she really helped us set up the focus group. And we learned from the focus group. And then what we learned from the focus group, we decided we should put this into a big data study. And she really helped us through that process of putting together our statement, right? And the reality is that's a draft of your opening and a draft of your closing, right? And so you're going through these iterative processes with her to help better understand, focus, target your case. You know, what are the things that jurors get mad about? You know, one of the cases we tried earlier this year that Sean and Amy were on and talked to you about, the jail suicide case, right?
Oh, yes.
You know, we used her on that. And in that case, we were up in arms about one fact, and we ran it through a focus group and data study. And they're like, we don't care about that fact. Here's the things that you should really be concerned about. And that was at play here too, right? Like we gave a script of the case with the defense side, with our side, and it helped us figure out what are the things we really need to be afraid of, what are the things that we can easily get around, and it really helps focus and streamline your case strategy, and then certainly that the damages asked as well, you know. And to your point earlier about asking for 1 million versus 5 million versus 25 versus 50, whatever, you know, the Campbells and the work that they've done, you know, that work routinely shows that there is a correlation between the ask and not just the amount of damages awarded, but also the strength of the liability verdict. And so that is very, very useful data to have. It also gives you juror profiles. Like any tool, for it to be useful, you got to use it. You know, and that's sometimes the difficult piece. You got all this information, all this data. It's like, well, what do I do with it? How do I incorporate it? How do you know? And so there could be a separate new struggle there. But overall, we've worked with Jessica in data studies several times now, and it's found very useful. Not cheap, but on 7-8-figure cases, definitely worth it.
Yeah. And I will say that I did have a judge give me big data on case costs recently. So, and it's hard too. I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on this, because you've got all this data, all this information, and then at some point you have to get it all out of your brain.
Yeah.
And you have to just stand in front of the jurors and like put on blinders. Is there some secret sauce that either of you have on how you can focus on the forest, not the trees, or whatever the saying is?
Well, I mean, we definitely used it to draft in like prioritize our voir dire questions. You know, we knew what was more important, and you know, some of the facts we thought were super important, the big data said, nah, that's not really as important as Greg and Tim thinks it is. Similarly, with some of the voir dire questions we thought were important, you know, the data didn't really back that up. And so you know, we just prioritized what we did based upon, or we tried to incorporate the big data and how to prioritize where we focused our time, you know, not perfectly, but it really helps you guide you where to go and spend energy. We used obviously the big data for the damages asks, and the big data also helped with the apportionment, which is, you know, how we kind of ended up letting Denver out. Big data kind of supported that. They didn't really, I mean, they pretty much told us what the apportionment was going to be, and it got pretty close to the data, to the results at trial. What else do we use big data? I think we use big data also to test some of the, we put some of the transcript testimony in there and got feedback on how some of the witnesses were perceived in focus groups as well. You can use it for a bunch of different things. The one thing that we didn't use big data for, which now I understand a little bit better, is they had that the cloud heat map, which has how frequent the focus group participants use certain words, right? Some words are bigger because they're more frequent. And we didn't intentionally incorporate that enough into trial. And you know, CTLA, I just heard Sean Claggett talk about it, and he presented on big data, and he says, you got to use that. You got to use whatever big words they're using, use those over and over with every witness. Like, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, while we probably did that somewhat, I think we could have been more intentional in using, you know, another data point from that data that we bought.
Yeah. There's just so, it's such a great profession because there's so much out there, and it's so easy to be passionate about this because we're, you know, finding on the good side and we have all these tools that are available. It's just fun to kind of get to play with all these little like toys that we get to play with to help achieve these results. One last line of questions that I have for you all, because I haven't mentioned it yet, but who were the defense firms that were on this case? Who's on this?
I laughed because there were a bunch and they kept evolving. I think, so MCI was the project owner. I think we went through four defense firms through the life of this case. One pre-lit, and then three different firms during litigation.
Wow.
And then for the general contractor, they had White and Steel. And then 2 weeks before trial, John Osgood parachuted in from Taylor Anderson.
Yeah.
And we had John Osgood in the Lieberman's case, that jail suicide case as well. Same thing, he parachuted in last minute. Used the same PowerPoint slide in his closing. So that was kind of fun. We're like, hey, we've seen this slide deck before. But it was like this just sort of revolving door. And the weird thing was they were all being indemnified by the same insurance company. So the same insurance company ultimately paid like six different firms to defend this case. But at trial, we had John Stevens, who had parachuted in maybe 2 weeks before trial as well, defending MCI. We had John Osgood defending the general contractor, and Doug Poling at White and Steel was also at trial defending the general contractor. And the city had its own city attorney, and Doug was also representing the city jointly with the city attorney as well while Denver was still in the case. So.
Wow. Well, congratulations on just an absolute amazing result. It sounds so easy when we talk to you guys about what you were able to accomplish. I mean, it's like, what an amazing story. Any takeaways that you'll take from this one in particular for future cases, Tim?
Yeah. So, and I'm glad you asked that, because we really wanted to make this as not chest pounding as some podcasts are. When
we're here to learn, man. We are here to learn.
That's right. And so we wanted, Greg and I actually talked for 30 minutes before coming on today and wanted to make sure that we had some takeaways for listeners. I think that one of the things that we did that was really well was make this a multimedia presentation. So in opening, we used PowerPoint. Again, we incorporated into that PowerPoint video depositions, documents. And I think that that is really good. We had some really creative moments during trial, and I'll let Greg talk about the one involving Skeletor. I used the King Board, which is just a giant flip chart. It's sort of like the Cadillac or Ferrari of flip charts, but it's really good. It's really good, and it's really effective. And I liken it to when we're in school, when the teacher writes something down on the blackboard, because so old that we have blackboards, that you write it down too. And I think the same is true of the jurors. If you're up there and you're seeing yourself in the role of educator, of teacher, and you're writing something on your King Board, do it with intention, do it with purpose. And I certainly saw jurors writing stuff down as I would write it on the blackboards or on the King Board as well. So I think that those were some good takeaways for us, or at least for me, just the importance of making sure you're not just there yapping. You're not just talking, because there's nothing worse than that. To make it as interesting Make it about the jurors. Make it interesting for the jurors. That's one of my key takeaways.
Right,
and Greg, do you want to talk about Skeletor? Because I think that was one of our key moments at trial.
Yeah. So, you know, Judge Wallace has some, she's very strict on disclosure requirements for experts. And she held the line evenly on both sides. But our experts, when we made disclosures, we didn't disclose all the demonstratives, which you usually don't have all your animations ready when you're doing your expert disclosures, which that's something we would do differently now. But we ended up not being able to use our, you know, anatomy animation to show all the different injuries on our client. And it was just the number of fractures in his face was so extensive. And without being able to visually show it, you just really couldn't understand it. And it was really important because he broke his orbital eye socket, the bottom part. And so the brain injury that he suffered was to the part of the frontal lobe that was behind this orbital eye socket. And so it's real low. And there's an issue is, you know, if you had a helmet, he would have still probably hit down here. And so it was one of the negligence issues. And we wanted to show, you know, he had three fractures down here and his nose and he, you know, hurt his neck and all this stuff. But then we didn't have the animation. And that was kind of a last minute. We didn't realize that that was going to happen. And so we had disclosed just a regular skeleton model.
Full body skeleton.
Yeah. So we just brought in, you know, we call it Skeletor. You know, we had Dr. Gray was our, you know, our first full day of trial. You know, she really laid the stage, you know, set the case for us. We brought the skeleton over to her and I, you know, the night before on Amazon, I did 2-hour delivery on some bright red masking tape. And I just gave Dr. Gray, you know, this roll of tape and we went through all the injuries and she just taped up the skeleton. And it was freaking awesome. And she had a really good time. And I think it's more effective to have, you know, that presentation created on the stand.
Yeah.
It's where the jury sees it. We're talking it through it. And then we have the skeleton just sitting there, you know, the whole time. Defense counsel keeps trying to move it out of the room and we keep moving it back and doing different things. You know, we ended up getting it admitted. It went back into the room. This table.
What?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't know. But I think that was more effective overall than playing a video. The video was smooth. I was sad we didn't get to use it. But creating that way more effective at trial. We could have made a blow up of all of our clients' injuries, but instead Tim went through them painstakingly with their own expert and put it on the board. And I think that process of creating it really helps you understand and remember it more than just putting something on the screen. It makes it interactive. We had a cone somewhere in the courtroom. And at one point we're like, you could have just put that cone up over there and this would have never happened, you know, and you know, the jury looks over and sees a big cone over there. And the witness is like, yep, that's right. And it's just kind of, you know, changing it up. You know, on one of the corporate witnesses, we had him on the stand and I was pointing to, you know, the king board, something Tim had just done. One of the experts were throwing, you know, videos or still shots up on the PowerPoint and just point, you know, like the jury's just constantly looking over there and just, it kept everyone's attention, I think. And it's important to switch it up. And it really, it creates like, you know, a difference between what we're doing and a lot of times what the defense is doing.
For sure.
You know, it doesn't seem like have free license to be creative and embrace it because it keeps, you know, everything moving and people interested, I think. And definitely, I think an interactive experience is the best way to describe what we tried to do. And it was fun too, frankly.
Oh, I just love it. I love it so much. And I think the thing that I am sensing most from both of you is that it seems like you both had a lot of fun in this trial. Is that accurate?
In hindsight, I mean, I will tell you, you know, by Thursday or Friday, Greg and I were both like on 2 weeks of 3 hours of sleep a night type of a thing. And, you know, it's hard work. It's hard work is what it is, but it is fun. And the sort of, when you're living in the moment of trial and sort of feeling that improv vibe, Greg and I are both big music fans. We sort of bonded over music when we were law school classmates because not a lot of, you know, law school classmates were really into music. And so I came from a record store. He had a background where I think he was doing some DJing and stuff. And so we bonded over that. But to me, trial's very much sort of that live improv feel. You just got to be in the moment and feel it and live it. And man, it can be a lot of fun. It can be a lot of work. It can be a lot of stress. Not fun for our wives probably while we're in trial, but trial can be so much fun. And knowing that you're on the right side of the case too, man.
Absolutely.
And you're trying to help people that are trying to get screwed over by an insurance company. It's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Can I talk about one other takeaway?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So, and I really want Greg to talk about this because he handled our closing and he did a beautiful job up till, you know, 3 a.m. preparing the night before or whatever it was. But it came off seamlessly and I thought he did a great job. But one thing that was a takeaway for us was something that he realized we didn't guard against, and it came back to bite us a little bit. Look, we're never going to be sad about an $8 million verdict, but we asked for a lot more. And so there's always a little bit of disappointment. We're like, damn it, why didn't we get there? And so there's this looking back at it, what could we have done better? And I want Greg to talk a little bit about one of those issues.
Yeah, so I think this kind of relates to what you're talking about, Keith, with, you know, the house with the rooms and how you value it. And I think from a cognitive perspective or from a persuasive perspective, you don't want to say, just come up with a number for this house. You want to look at the rooms individually. And I think that, well, I know from talking to the jury that they ended up with a number and then they backed into it with all the other numbers. And so I would take that a little bit more head on next time and say, you know, explicitly, you know, please don't try to back into a number. Think about each one of these things separately. I think I could have done a little bit better on that, on the impairment, because then, you know, maybe you shortchange the valuation on the individual things that I think are all individually worth more valuable than if you just do the collective house. And I really like the way I'm going to go look at, you know, the Sari de la Motte thing and look at the house and see if that's a better way to explain it. But certainly try to guard against letting them pick a number and then backing into it. Because I just don't think that's not justice. And that's not what I want, you know, for my clients.
Yeah, it's so useful. And we also have been utilizing that same we use instead of per diem, we do it per year based upon the different levels of impairments, whether it's physical impairments that we would then tie to an FCE, and then the other types of impairments that would be tied to other witnesses. And when we reset, go to trial on our case in March of next year, I'll just tell you guys, the freaking Arapahoe County Court did not have enough jurors. So when we got up in brutal honesty, started kicking jurors, because it's a motorcycle, no helmet motorcycle case, everyone's like, I can't be fair, can't be fair, can't be fair. Boom, not enough jurors, mistrial.
Man.
6 months later.
Yeah.
So that's a lesson. Like, if you know that you've got issues, that you're going to have a lot of cause challenges, ask the judge in advance to make sure he brings enough jurors. I would have never, ever thought about that in a million years.
So I agree with you 100%. Another thought on that, and this is something Greg did that I didn't even know about. So talk to your judge about the issues in the case and how many jurors they're going to call and why you think you need an expanded jury panel. Beyond that, there's a statute that lets you get information about the jury panel ahead of time.
Hmm.
And so if you're so inclined to do research on those people, you can ask the court to disclose, and we did in this case, to disclose the names of potential jurors. And,
nice.
You can do some research on that. Given that some states you get days and days of voir dire, not here, as we all know. So, but yeah, that's another piece. And I don't remember the statute off my top of my head, but if you reach out to Greg, I'm sure if anyone's interested, provide that.
Well, and let's wrap it up with, how do people get a hold of you if they want to co-counsel cases with you? Tim, Greg, I mean, obviously you're with Dormer Hyperine, but how? What's the best way for people to reach out?
So Tim, and my email is just tmg@denvertrial.com. Cell phone 303-564-6707. Happy to talk to anyone anytime. Whether people want to co-counsel with us or not, not really the point. I'm really big on mentoring and helping young attorneys figure this out, because the truth is, I didn't have that, or I had to fight for it and figure out how to do it and discover it on my own. And you know, you pick up friends, you pick up mentors along the way. Many of mine came from books. And so it's a lot easier sometimes to just have someone to bounce ideas off of. And I'm always willing to make time for attorneys, young or old, to help rising tides.
Yeah, my email is gdb@denvertrial. Absolutely shoot me an email anytime if you have questions or if I can send you anything. Happy to share whatever we got. I love helping people. I love the community, helping everybody. I love what Keith's doing. I love the CTLA listserv. You know, add us on LinkedIn if that's an easy way to communicate. You know, whatever we can do to help. We love it. And we love that, you know, it seems like everyone's working together to get better and better outcomes for the clients. Cause just that's the most important part.
And I got to say one last piece, like, this is me and Greg on this podcast, and we're honored that you have us here, but this was not me and Greg winning this case. You know, we could not have done this with the great team around us, including my trial paralegal, who was our main trial paralegal at trial, Marcy, Greg's trial paralegal, a litigation paralegal. Cindy also was a huge help in this. I also had my pre-lit paralegal fly out to help us during trial, our legal assistant fly out to help us during trial, and Sean came and helped argue some jury instructions for us. So, I mean, this was a huge team win, and I think every single win is always a team win. You know, as attorneys, we're the face of this, but I don't know any attorneys that are truly doing it on their own and at this level. So while I appreciate you having us on, we can't take nearly all of the credit for that.
Well, thank you guys both for coming on. It is such an inspiration. And I really do love doing this for the same reason that you guys kind of touched on, which is every time I come on, I feel like I learned something new. I'm inspired. And so thank you both for coming on the show. And thank you, listeners, for listening to the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection podcast. Spread the word. The whole mission of this podcast is just to help make us all better. So come on the show. If you've got a case you want to talk about, something that you did that you're really proud of, reach out to me. Let me know. Let's get you on the show. And until next time, I'm Keith Fuselli, and we'll see you again on the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection podcast.
Thanks, Keith.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for joining us. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration from today's courtroom warriors. And thank you for being in the arena. Make sure to subscribe and join us next time as we continue to dissect real cases and learn from Colorado's top trial lawyers. Our mission is to empower our legal community, helping us to become better trial lawyers to effectively represent our clients. Keep your connection to Colorado's best trial lawyers alive at www.thectlc.com.